And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Joseph Atfill and Ryan Gilmore about the Covert Messiah, of course, the upcoming event, and then also the work of Joseph Atfill that has to do with his Flavian signature, or Caesar's Messiah, and also the new upcoming The Single Strand. And I wanted to go back a little bit more than Joseph, as we kind of just we'll jump a little bit back and forth here in the timeline, but that's all right. We were talking about the Flavians, you mentioned the Patricians, but I wanted to ask you a little bit more about some of the other groups, if you will, that were around at that time. We have, for example, the Despotini is another branch, if you will, at that era. But how can we see this group move forward in history? Do they later become, you know, the European kings or queens, or are we talking about people who are actually hiding behind the throne as the kingmakers, Joseph?
Very interesting. I suspect, without any hard evidence at this point, of course, that the ruling class doesn't reveal its ethnicity. It would keep that hidden from the peasants and serfs, because as in the case of Christianity, if too much of the genealogy is revealed, then you'd have a rebellion. People would know that they were in fact enslaved and they weren't in a religion at all. As far as other groups, the one that of course is the most interesting to me would be the group that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. Very warrior-like, fundamental Jewish organization. Nothing really is known or agreed upon by scholars about this, but I believe that the Dead Sea Scrolls are the literature of the Messianic movement. I think that this literature was the literature that the Romans thought inflamed the Jews to rebel. And the organization it describes, I think, actually has a joke, or at least wordplay, in the Gospels that to describe it. Jesus is said at one point in the Gospels to be a tecton, and he is said at another to be the son of a tecton. Tecton is translated in the King James Version as carpenter, but actually it means stonemason. In Greece today, the word means Freemason, the organization of the Freemasons. And so that's very interesting to me, because the Freemasons have such a direct connection to the Knights Templar, that sort of mysterious organization that was in the Middle Ages and had one of the leaders was de Molay, who was executed by the Vatican. There was some mysterious struggle that took place between de Molay's group and the Vatican. But the Knights Templar, I think, may have direct relations to the organization that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. The only, hard bit of evidence I have to support that is simply that they're, by tradition, have said to have gone back to the Temple of Jerusalem to try to uncover something that they had hid there before the temple had actually been raised. So this would suggest that the organization had a Judean provenance and could well have been this group that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, if you move forward, what you see is that the group that came from Scotland, the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, has this direct lineage to de Molay. They actually cite him as one of their founders. And, for example, Bill Clinton, the U.S. president, attended de Molay school as a child, which was, it's a organization that the Freemasons, American Freemasons, run.
I know Bill Clinton was big into the Knights of Columbus, I think it was, wasn't it, Bill Clinton?
Well, I mean, there's different groups that link back to it, but I look at the relationship between de Molay and Freemasonry.
Yeah.
And so the connection that it looks to me that I think is interesting, is worth exploring, would be that of the Tectons, and to see how they essentially have existed throughout history. The really interesting connection is from Scotland through to the United States. If you look at the poetry of Robert Burns, he has all of this Masonic homage, you know, where he's praising the organization that which he's a member of, these Freemasons, and then he praises all of the founders of the American nation that are members of the organization: Washington, Franklin, Hamilton. He mentions them by name. And so I'd really like to see, you know, some research done in this. It's, you know, I'm not, not to suggest a paranoid state here, but I just think that alert citizens should know this. And I would really like to, you know, for example, explore the fact that Robert Burns uses the expression the Sons of Light to describe his organization. Mm-hmm. And that's an expression from the Dead Sea Scrolls. So, you know, just it's curious to me, and I'd like to see more research done in this area.
I find it interesting that it took a while for the Dead Sea Scrolls to be made public. And I'm sure, Joe, you were waiting for them to come out when that was announced.
What is, why was it held back consciously, or did someone not want this to be revealed at a certain time?
Yeah,
maybe?
I mean, it was quite a scandal. They had them, and then for some reason they wouldn't release the translations of perhaps the most explosive material for over 50 years. And
That's right.
So that was one of the things I was very curious about when I sort of began trying to understand the origins of Christianity, is, well, why the heck aren't they releasing this material? I've done some work with Robert Eisenman and have written some papers with Bob. And, you know, he was really probably the individual who's most instrumental in getting the scrolls finally given to the public. But the relationship between the group that wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls and the, you know, organization that created the Christian Gospels is simply antagonistic. The idea that, you know, one group came from the other is absurd. The Dead Sea Scrolls describe a really xenophobic, warrior-like messianic cult, and Christianity, of course, is pro-Roman, and the Messiah is saying turn the other cheek. So obviously there's some relationship that is that has to be understood between them, but it's not that one emerged from the other.
But one, there was an attempt to create another version of this Judaism, correct?
A pacified version of it, yes, because it was threatening, because it had, I mean, the Messiah, I mean, here's an example of, just like Orwell talks about it, totally reversing the meaning of a word as a way to take control of people's minds is, I mean, the word Messiah, we have this image of Jesus when we think of that word now, but it really is the complete opposite of what the word Messiah was in the first century and before. It was a it was like King David. It was a warrior king that would wipe out the enemies with the power of God, and so the peaceful Messiah that we think of Jesus. I mean, that is an attempt by the Romans to get control of this and say, oh, no, it's completely opposite. It's the Messiah is someone who hangs around with Roman tax collectors and. And he doesn't rebel. He allows himself to be taken away to the cross. So he sort of he's the opposite of a warrior, and that's the original meaning of Messiah. And I think there are people today who believe in the old definition of Messiah.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, it depends on who you ask and on what point, even in the Bible, I guess. Because I mean, if we look at Revelations again, we have Jesus coming back with, like, you know, fire in his eyes to burn out the enemy, and it's all about cherry picking, I guess, from the Bible, right? Because in certain instances, it's very peace loving, hippy dippy, and other regards is extremely violent, right? So I mean, it's
right. You can just take whatever you want, and that's really the whole problem.
That's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, most people relate to the pacifist Jesus, and they know his quotes, and they think this is a wonderful individual. Others are actually aware of quotes that Jesus makes that are very dangerous and violent, and can, you know, promote you know, negative behavior. And then, moreover, because Christianity has merged its literature with the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew Bible then becomes normalized. And instead of, Gentiles looking at Psalm 137 and saying, well, this is completely insane, somehow because the Hebrew Bible has led to the prophecies of Jesus being fulfilled and by the individual they think is the Son of God, well, you normalize those parts of the Hebrew Bible that would attract sociopathic impulses.
And that's why I think black propaganda is a bad idea. We've been convinced, well, sometimes we need the CIA and MI6 to do these black propaganda operations because we've got to control religious extremists. And this, and this comes to today because this is going on in the Middle East for, trying to control Islamic extremists. And
or create it, as some people have said.
Or create it as well. Yeah. But I mean, there are people in these PSYOP battalions, say in America, for example, who, what they think they're doing. I mean, they're proud soldiers trying to do their best for their country, and they think they're presenting white propaganda, and white propaganda meaning you just try and convince people with the truth, and they believe, we're trying to spread freedom and democracy in the Middle East, and try and control this radical Islamic element. And but I think by studying Joe's work, it shows that this noble lie can completely backfire on you. Because like Joe's saying, they had this Hebrew Bible that had these very psychopathic parts into it that was inspiring a rebellion in the Roman Empire, and they thought themselves as very superior to the Jews, and I think that arrogance backfired because they thought, well, we'll just take it over and we'll just lie to the citizens. And
yeah,
I just think it's a bad idea because and this is by knowing our real history, we can show, yeah, this can be really bad. If they thought this was a way to control psychopaths through deception and tricking them, well, aren't you using the same tricks? And maybe there's a better way.
Well, exactly. I mean, you're absolutely right. I think at times as well, I don't think that they know really what they're doing or kind of what they're releasing. They're opening that Pandora's box, if you will, because at times it seems that they're more interested in creating chaos to be able to, offer some kind of remote assistance to call this chaos. But at other times, certainly they have very much everything under control and everything is very, very regulated. But to me, it's I think that when they're creating these myths in history, when they're, ramping up this violent groups, etc., to what they see ultimately is going to benefit their agenda to take control of the show, if you will, the planet. I think that they are releasing things that they're not quite aware of what they're doing. And things have, I think, backfired in the past. What do you think, Ryan?
Well, I guess it depends on who you're talking to. Like I was talking about some of the sort of soldiers on the ground who are part of these psychological operation units, and they believe what they're doing is right. And but the thing is, there's so many layers of false history, false ideas that when you study the Caesar's Messiah thesis, you see, wow, this goes back a long way. Very, very sophisticated types of propaganda, which that I think most people don't even realize how sophisticated that it is. They think they're able to recognize and see through the lies, but the ruling classes that have gone through history, they've built up some very very amazing techniques on how to completely control our reality, and where we don't know which way is up, which way is down. How can we make any logical decisions when we've got totally false history and we're worshiping false gods?
Right.
It's very difficult. And if the what we're calling the truth movement, and I can't do this, and I think they are. I sort of see it as a truth seeking movement, and we're, thanks to the internet, I think we are starting to deprogram ourselves from this. And I think that's sort of the stage we are at right now. We're still searching, and we're trying to shake off the programming, but it's still difficult. There's still a lot of work that we have to get through and a lot of studying we have to do to figure out what's reality. It's
sure. Oh, yeah.
Very tough.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think people jump the gun way too quickly and are, you know, they're so certain that they have all the picture, when I think that there's a lot more to be revealed history. I mean, I'm much more humble in that way to this task of piecing together this immense puzzle and the layers of just propaganda and everything else. And but you know, everyone is on a different journey, I guess, and they can go there. But I've done that in the past. I've jumped to something and thought, wait a minute, this is I got the truth. Here it is, you know. And then later you're smacked in the face.
Truth isn't a prize. It's like a marriage. It's got to be a constant back and forth relationship.
That's right.
Your thoughts, getting data and double checking it, and so it's just a constant relationship. I mean, we think we've got it now, and it's not like a jewel that you can hold in your hand and you've got the truth. It really is, you've always got to nurture it. Like, truth is just a continuous relationship you've got to keep up.
Very good. Beautifully said. Now, Joseph, I wanted to ask you more about this pacification as well, because I think the overall image that is portrayed throughout the whole of the religion is the message that, you know, it's more virtuous, basically, to give everything away, to remain poor, you know, the meek shall inherit the earth, this kind of idea. And I think that this has been one of the headlines, if you will, that the wolves has put out, so that there would be no resistance from the sheep, if you know what I'm getting at, Joseph.
Of course. I'll give you a good example, a recent one. During World War II, an anthropologist named Gregory Bateson, who was the husband of Margaret Mead, had studied social groups. And in a letter that Dr. David Price had obtained and published in his book, Weaponizing Anthropology, he points out that Bateson had determined or knew about experiments that the Russians had done with their Siberian populations at around 1900, whereby they had determined how to best enslave them, best control them. And the Russians had determined that they needed to set up what they called an archaic revival. In other words, they had to make them, these Asiatic Indian tribes, they had to make them want to embrace their past, so that they wouldn't be envious about modern technology or try to acquire any, but rather would, you know, engage in dance and all of these attributes that had to do with their past. You tried to move to essentially retrograde the intellect of the culture and make them think that was something they wanted to embrace. Well, very interesting that Bateson was at the foundation of the CIA project called MKUltra, which then has all of these strange connections into the psychedelic movement and the hippie movement, the rock and roll music movement, that all these things came out in the 60s. And so when I look at this, it looks to me as though basically, this was the youth movement that came about in the late 60s was essentially an experiment to determine if it was possible to create an archaic revival using the elements that had worked well with in the Russian experiments. And particularly when you look at the fact that these groups that the Russians were studying had the psilocybin mushroom as part of their culture, and that was something that they wanted them to, in the native revivalism that the Russians are trying to produce, to have them embrace. Well, when you look at what goes on in the 60s, and you have people like Ken Kesey and Robert Hunter, all of these famous icons of the psychedelic movement, mm-hmm. having been employees of MKUltra. It sure is suspicious. And just as an aside, One of the reasons that I became sort of interested in the idea that neo-feudalism was essentially being developed, right now by our governments, is because I came across a book called A Course in Miracles, written by Thetford and Schumann, who were two psychometricians. They were very specialized psychologists studying how the human mind operated. And they produced this book, A Course in Miracles, which became the foundation of neo-Christianity. Schumann claimed that Jesus was channeling through her, that she was literally able to bring Jesus's current philosophy to the planet. Mm-hmm. Well, that just seemed very suspicious to me in light of my discoveries that the Flavians had produced Christianity and that Constantine had used it as a mind control device.
Right.
And so then when I started researching these two, I found an amazing fact. They were both employees of this thing called MKUltra, the CIA project that had to do with mind control. And so it sure looked suspicious to me. Then when, you know, other facts started to come out, like, for example, that Gordon Wasson, who was the original discoverer of the psilocybin mushroom in terms of the American public, that he too was a member of this MKUltra project. And then finally, as you go forward, you have this guy, Dennis McKenna, talking about an archaic revival, right? He's talking about embracing the past and this communal living, dropping out, forgetting technology. The pattern sure looked suspicious to me.
Yeah.
And so this is an example of how when, you know, we look at our history, we have it, it's been given to us as history. That's how our mind connects to it. These supposedly, you know, are events that actually occurred and shaped the culture, et cetera, et cetera. But I would suggest we have a different way of looking at these things, that we look at them first with the possibility that they have been deliberately designed to create influence that the ruling classes want in the population. So that's my example of modern aspect of mind shaping, of neo-feudalism, and it's kind of the stuff that hopefully at the venue in October we can really get into in great depth.
I mean, that's a magnificent example. This shows the playpen, how that has been created for us, and specifically, you know, the young people, youth coming in, because obviously it's about channeling then that rebellious energy that is there, you know, natively in young people. They're there to question society. And I think that although that this had a great value in the past, these social engineers have found a way to harness this energy to change the society towards a direction that leads to this neo-feudalist state that you're talking about. And I think
absolutely. And Henrik, just congratulations. That is a wonderful and clear description of what has happened and what we are. We are in a playpen that has been constructed to essentially keep us in a state that's easy to control.
Oh, and you know, the imagination is a wonderful thing, but it can be weaponized.
Exactly. And I think today as well, we see, you know, revisions and different versions, depending on what region we're talking about. And again, we're talking about major chess players in history here who are, you know, accustomed to massively influence, you know, a large number of people, populations. And I think that, you know, we can see the echoes of this in the color revolution in the east of Europe. We've seen it now with the so-called Arab Spring. I mean, we see the same kind of patterns, and in some cases we even have the same players behind it, actually, while in the Western world we've kind of now leaned, for the youth at least, kind of into this techno utopia a little bit, but at the center and at the core of all this is still this kind of central entity called the state or the government there to kind of oversee the whole process. And I just wonder how many revisions that this actually has gone through, and the fact that we have not yet managed to kind of see through the plan, see through it in the full context and take us out of that. I don't know if that's, you know, just discouraging, or the fact that we're sitting here talking about it today might be a sign at least that you know, someone is onto it, if you will.
It's not discouraging. Look, you know, we have in the United States, we have what's called the American Dream. And I believe that the title was deliberately picked. It is a dream, and there has always been groups that have had power that the population is unaware of. And these groups have always had plans. And you mentioned earlier the possibility that they might lose control from time to time and unleash forces that they're not wishing to have unleashed. I don't agree with that. I think that they've always had a general idea of what will happen, and specifically that populations will be reduced and certain groups will be impoverished. And so I really don't see accidents. What I see is a general plan that has been successful. So in our present circumstance, with the never-ending wars and the never-ending financial crisis, none of which ever seems to get any better, right? Never seems to somehow be fixable. What are we dealing with? Is this, in fact, just another playpen that is being constructed that leads to population reduction? Well, I believe it is. And I think that that citizens will never make any progress in these areas. They will never stop the wars that were described and prophesized by PNAC in 1999, I believe is when it came out.
Yeah.
And they will never fix the financial crisis because they're not really designed to be fixed. They're designed to operate just as they are.
That's right.
They're designed to, in terms of the financial crisis, to simply defund the population, thereby obviously making them easier to control. And I think if you look going back to, the counterculture, because that's the correct term, the counterculture that came about in the late 60s, you know, it produces the single mom. It produces the single male who hustles for sex at bars at night. You know, the family is being destroyed.
Yeah.
Now, was this a force that just was accidentally released? No, I don't think so, because if you start tracing it to today, you see that everything that has happened has led to the populations, the Western populations, being de-intellectualized, being defunded, being depopulated in many cases, and now facing these financial catastrophes and endless wars. I mean, you can really imagine the end of the whole population in a very short period of time, almost just with this the process continuing that we're in at this very moment. There's nothing that has to be added. So, these are not moments that you can just say, well, you know, I'm just going to let history unfold here. You know, this is the time that citizens have to stand up. And to in the United States, the first thing, of course, and I don't mean to, you know, become histrionic, but we have to restore the Constitution because it's been taken from us, obviously. And so, you know, this is a time when the citizen has to stand up and recognize that we're in a process that will lead to neo-feudalism and to find a way to prevent it.
Let me ask you this a little bit. I think it was interesting when you talked about basically how sexuality has changed as well, because it's obvious here that Christianity and religion overall has a part to play in this, and a much longer part, I think, because it's just by suppressing, for example, the natural, you know, sexual drives and tendencies that are there, that you actually create a person that becomes disassociated with a very, very natural impulse. So while holding it back for, you know, generations in some cases, when that lid is revealed or you know, let go, you have a tremendous power, if you will, in that. And if you can manage, again, as I said before, to channel that, you can change things tremendously quick. I mean, with the sexual revolution and everything else that went on in the 60s, kind of coinciding with LSD as well, it was obvious to those people then that, oh, this is all, you know, Christianity's fault, and it's, you know, just as long as we go in the opposite direction to what they did, we're going to be all good. But you're still stuck in the dialectic, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, we're stuck between a rock and a hard place, because we're all the models that we have for what's a good society. I mean, what do we have? I mean, that's when people look at the problems of today, we recoil at the rapid changes. We might want to say, yeah, well, we better go back to older times and go back to something like Christianity. And some of that may be good. But when you look at Joe's work and see, well, that was a psychological warfare operation from 2,000 years ago, it's like we're struggling right now to find a model to go by. And that's the work we have to do, is figure out, don't let's not take our models from what we learn at school or what the government says is the good society. It's something we are, if we're going to make it through this sort of crisis of our age, is we're going to have to figure that out.
Well, maybe the model is no model. Consequently, there's something that can't be hijacked or taken over or channeled in a weird way.
I wanted to comment on the sexuality.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, in the 60s, sexuality was given to the youth of America as the primary component of the counterculture. If you wanted to get laid, you had to have long hair, you know. The rock idols all had, you know, had adopted the attributes of drug use, and they were presumably, you know, having sex. And so sex was really given as a tool to break up the social structure and families. Do your own thing. The playboy, these concepts suddenly come into the culture at the same time, you know, that the drugs were being given. And I don't think any of this is circumstance. I think that this was just part of the archaic revival that they had in mind. They just wanted to take the baby boomer in Europe and the United States and just gently move them in a bad direction so that they wouldn't develop skills that would have ended up being problematic for the oligarchs.
You see how we could be controlled in older times by repressing sexuality and then also letting sexuality run rampant. Both sides can be used for control, and
you have to remember the oligarchs don't have any power if they only control one side of the dialectic. If they just, you know, you read about these billionaires that give money to the Republican Party or billionaires that give money to the Democratic Party. Well, how absurd. Giving money to one political party. What kind of power is that for an oligarch?
That's right.
Obviously, they control both parties, and the dialectic that they have, the little struggle, is fake. So sex is just another piece of the playpen. They can use it on either side. The culture that we've been given has led to a complete catastrophe, whereby even though technology has moved forward dramatically and has produced a much better listening devices for the government and more sophisticated weapons, somehow it hasn't produced any more wealth for the population. Just an amazing accident of history, eh? So all of the things that have occurred and been given to us as culture really for the last 100 years need to be suspected as having been part of the design to take us to a place where we're easier to control. And how do we move forward? Well, first, very first step is we have to understand who is controlling us.
We have to understand what kind
of attack is being directed against us. What sort of techniques are used to shape our minds? See, we've got to understand what is negative and controlling us so that we know what to fight. Because at the moment, you know, the things that are heroic in many instances, you know, when you actually dig into the reality, they were there to take you to a bad place. I mean, the rock idols that have such direct connections to the military intelligence, I think, are a really good example of this. You know, the primary being Jim Morrison of the Doors, whose father was Admiral Morrison, the individual responsible for the now vetted false flag operation that got the U.S., excuse me, that was used as the cover story so that the U.S. could have the war in Vietnam. So, you know, this individual's background just cannot be circumstance given, I think, you know, disclosures now in terms of MKUltra's role in producing the counterculture. And you can see that the history we have is not just fake, but it is destructive. See, this is really the hard part in my mind, is people recognizing that their own mind is really what is been damaging them, that all of these historical elements that they see as positive are, in fact, have been given to them so that they can be more easily controlled. So It's a long process. We unfortunately don't have a lot of time, but it's one that everyone needs to participate in. We need to support one another in the process. We need to, you know, I always say, look, if any of these concepts worry you or they resonate somehow, you find something in you that says, you know, gee, these guys seem to be onto something, seem to be really giving an explanation for my reality that seems better than the one I'm getting on CNN. Well, the thing to do is to try to find a friend to share this information with. And then the two of you, the first thing you do is say, well, who else can we essentially share our understanding? Try to develop techniques to get clearer understandings of the events that are presented to us as terrorism or financial catastrophes or things like this that are just given to us as the media, but always end up being so destructive to us.
Yeah, focus, analyze, make sure to, study it properly and really exactly. Be there, you know, definitely. I wanted to ask you another thing, Joseph, here, while you kind of brought up this topic, but it has to do, you mentioned, you know, technology before, that some groups in the past have resisted it. And I also see another then dialectic part of this as well, a kind of a counter, point to this. But if we look at Apple and Steve Jobs as being, you know, kind of one of the pinnacle men that has kind of brought this new technology to the forefront. He's, of course, coming out of the 60s, a user of LSD. You know, we did a TV episode about this that we kind of detailed the occult origins, if you will, of Apple and everything else. And I don't want to say just because he, you know, took acid doesn't mean that his ideas wasn't genuine or something like that, or that the CIA covertly controlled him. But I do see that they kind of released a genie from the bottle, if you will, that kind of opened up. And what's been interesting with Apple, there was actually a book recently written about this called Appletopia by Brett T. Robinson that basically showed how religious motifs have been inserted into the brand of Apple. And this is used in many other, you know, companies as well, of course, but Apple have been really, really successful at it, to these highly charged, rich, symbolic motifs being inserted. And the dedication is that it's kind of like a new religion. I mean, I think that the Apple building in New York is the most photographed building right now. When people go there, it's the new cathedral, basically, you know. And I just find it interesting that technology here that we have is of course, as you said, very, very beneficial, but we have a flip side to it, which is this kind of, you know, when mankind begins to merge into the technology, kind of a transhuman neo-feudal society that is a kind of right there and waiting for us to kind of just walk through that door. What do you think about this, Joseph?
Well, I think that 100% of the internet and communication technology has been brought under control by the oligarchs, and that if you look at any of the large organizations, Microsoft or Google or Apple, that are, you know, involved in this, you will not have to dig too deep before you're going to find the same group that Bateson was working with when he was developing MK Ultra, and the counterculture that comes out of Palo Alto and San Francisco that now is Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
So I really think that I see no chance whatsoever that the symbol of CBS was the all-seeing eye. I think that that's obviously a clue to the perspective of the people who are bringing the visual media to the population, and obviously they're going to use it as a controlling element. I really am very troubled by all of the time that people spend with these devices. This hasn't been vetted. We don't know where this is going to take us. And then beyond that, just the power it gives to those who control. It's literally as though they have electric energy inside our brain that they can now manipulate whenever they choose. So, because I believe it is clear we have oligarchic control, hidden oligarchic control, right? I think that you just can't trust what is given to us as mass media whatsoever. The mass media of a serf in the fourth century was what was leading him to accept his slavery. And gee whiz, here we are, 1,500 years later, and the same exact system, it appears to be in place again.
Yeah.
The mass media is just how is never, the oligarchs are never not in manipulative control over it, because it is where the ideas form. You have to be able, if you want to control the population, you've got to control the flow of ideas. Remember what happened to the Gnostic Gospels and the Dead Sea Scrolls. Remember how Rome destroyed them, how they controlled how exactly and what kind of literature could be given.
Yeah.
These patterns are repeating themselves. You just need to, while the internet is still open, use it against them. You need to use it as a way to communicate the ideas of a real, a culture that works for the benefits of its members, yeah, rather than just for the benefits of the controlling oligarch.
Yeah. Ryan, any comments on this?
Well, I think it is starting to happen. I think you commented me on my website and my graphics. You know, I learned those skills in the corporate world, and so there's lots of regular people who can use the skills they've learned sort of in the system to try and change the system. So I think definitely we should, even though the internet came out of DARPA, that, yeah, we should use it.
Now, before we carry on, I want to ask you guys about Shakespeare here, and just tie that in here towards, you know, the end a little bit later here in the last 10 minutes or so. But maybe we could talk a little bit more about depopulation. You know, we can begin with you, Joseph, and how you see this, and how you see, well, we made a kind of an analogy in the break there between, we're talking about the cold depopulation, if you will, that cold war that actually is ongoing right now, where we have massive amounts of people being in an environment that are basically making them sick, from the food to the clothing that they use to the materials and fabrics and everything else that they are surrounded by. And that the basic, you know, kind of problem here is that most people don't know, they don't understand, they have not researched the connections or the origins of basically the entire bubble, and again, the playpen that we are in today. How do you see this depopulation playing out, Joseph?
Well, very tragically, it appears that virtually everything that is in our environment that is mass produced is analyzed by the oligarchs in terms of what it does to population. I think that the dramatic reduction in sperm count in Europe and the United States is not accidental. I think obviously they can monitor this. I think that the cross-gender hormonal chemicals that are in milk and meats and clothing, as a matter of fact, that can essentially make an individual's sexuality ambivalent. I don't think these things are appearing accidentally. So basically, the citizen just has to be aware that he is, or she is, at war, and that war is being waged against them. And it is simply a very clever, covert style of war, but the effect of it is to make them easier to control, to make them dumber, poorer, sicker. And so one of the things people can do, of course, is just to improve their diet. I mean, at this club I go to, it's a beach club, and it has photographs of the population when the club began, which was in 1925, something like that.
Wow.
It has dozens of photographs. I look at those pictures, and then I walk outside and see the current crop, and I would say they're about 100 pounds overweight. There's no muscle tone.
Yeah.
No one is obese in these pictures. No one looks sick. So we are under attack in every way. You know, they attack us through the ideas we have, which are bad and self-destructive. They attack us through our foods, in the chemicals that are around them, particularly in the drugs that they take, in the media and the history that they're given. These things have all been vetted as what you described, Henrik, as the playpen. It's just something to control people, keep them in a little tiny area, and of course to make them sicker, easier to control, and dumber, can't think clearly. So you have to just be more skeptical, create friendships and alliances that can work toward better thinking, better health, and do it quickly, and then try to convert that into political activity. Try to make these issues become parts of the debate that should be going on when candidates come forward.
Indeed, from GMO to you know, the corn syrup and the you know,
absolutely,
corn flour and everything else. I mean, it's just, I mean,
that stuff is absolute poison.
Yeah.
And and people that eat the food that have the synthetic oils in them, and the steroids and the hormones and the antibiotics. I mean, it's a death sentence. And it, you know, going back to the pictures that I have in this club of the people in 1925. It is simply a great tragedy that, you know, people who are obese and weak and cannot think with energy, that they don't recognize that this isn't a natural condition, that this is something that has been caused and something they can do something about.
Well, exactly. In most cases, as we've found out when we look into this, when it comes to the hormone, you know, altering, you know, foods and materials and everything else, that the research on this has been done. They know about this. If you actually go to the science, it shows clearly that it's bad for you. It affects you in this way. It completely messes with your endocrine system and your reproductive, you know, organs and everything else. There, you know, all of this stuff is known, but yet it still continues because you have a layer of, you know, quote unquote education among the scientists out there and the people perceive that it's safe and it's okay, because it has been approved by the very few people who know what they're doing, kind of thing. So it is kind of an idiocracy world that we are, you know, moving towards right now. If you guys have seen that film, I mean, it's a scary,
yes.
it's a scary kind of prediction right there, you know?
It's a great satire.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I mean, I don't even think it's a prediction. It simply has come to pass, and it should be a call to action by those whose minds are still energetic enough to see how war is being waged against the citizens, and to do everything that they need to do to stop it, to make other people aware. In the venue in London, I'm really going to try to promote political action to whatever extent I'm able to.
It's survival at this stage. That's what we're talking about.
Exactly right. That's what it's down to.
Let's talk about Shakespeare here now in the last few, 5-10 minutes or so. And if we need to go over, we can certainly do that as well, guys. So don't keep that in mind. But Shakespeare, tie this in for us, how you've found a typology in his work and a reversal and everything else. This is just a fascinating topic.
Well, at the end of Caesar's Messiah, Joe, you asked, who else knows about this? Does anyone else know about this typology?
Right. It was curious to me whether or not other authors had come across the typological system, because I had, and I thought, well, if I can decode it, other people can. Where is that information? And so one day I read Titus Andronicus, a little-known Shakespearean play, because of the the title of the lead character, Titus. And I was just curious to see if there was some sort of linkage to the Titus Flavius. And lo and behold, it turned out that the entire play was, in fact, a response to the Flavian's writing of the Gospels. You can tell very easily that the play is in some way a comment on the Flavian family, because at the very beginning of the play, there's a passage which states, I'm going to have to do this by memory, but something to the effect that someone asked the character Titus what his brother's doing. And Titus says, well, he is alone and killing flies. And the individual said, well, this doesn't become the brother of Titus to be alone and kill flies. And Titus says, well, he's alone and killing flies. So the author just repeats the concept over and over, even though it's seemingly a non sequitur. Well, those who are familiar with Suetonius know who Shakespeare is referring to. The brother of Titus, Domitian, was famous for being by himself and killing flies. That was what he was best known for. So the play was clearly some symbolic comment on the Flavians, and it's not too hard to see what that is when you look at the end of the play, and you can see that the character Titus Andronicus, he gets a group of people to unwittingly eat human flesh. Now, of course, that is the inside joke that I point out in Caesar's Messiah, that that Titus has created literature whereby the Messianic movement, the leaders of it, because the apostles in the Gospels are a satire of the leaders of the Messianic movement, Simon, John, Eleazar, Matthew, Judas. These are all names of the leaders of the real Messianic movement. So Jesus gets them to unwittingly eat human flesh. Well, in Titus Andronicus, lo and behold, Titus does it again, except this time it's the Gentiles that are unwittingly made to eat human flesh. And so it then, you know, was curious to me as to why this pattern had been reversed. And I could see, in a number of ways that, in fact, the entire body of Shakespearean literature was just a reversing. In other words, it was a Jewish joke against the Gentiles, just as the Christian Gospels were a Roman body of literature that purported to be Jewish, but in fact was a comic insult of them. So the Shakespearean literature was in fact a Jewish response, purportedly written by a Gentile, which in fact was a comic mocking of the Gentile royal family. Even the individual's name, which is in the folio, is given as Will Shakespeare, is simply a comic pun. In other words, the idea is that it's a martial description that the Jews have not been crushed by Christianity, and Will Shakespeare, you see, that's why they chose this individual's name. And and so, in fact, all of the literature had been written by almost all of the literature, the Shakespearean literature, written by a Jewish woman named Amelia Bassano. Her family was a rabbinical family, came from Italy, in the area that the Shakespearean plays had that were written about in Italy, Verona and Venice. They were brought to England by Henry VIII to improve his court instruments. His musical instruments. They were musicians and builder of musical instruments. They were what were called Muranos, which is an insulting term indicating that they were crypto Jews. In other words, they pretended to be Gentiles because had converted to Christianity, because in that era there were no Jews permitted in England. But in fact, they worshipped within the Jewish religion, and this is demonstrated by the fact that two of Amelia Bassano's cousins were found to be worshiping at a secret synagogue and were arrested and racked and then killed. So in Shakespeare, you have little tidbits that should have given scholars sort of a clue about this. I mean, one obvious one would be like the character Macbeth. Macbeth, at the beginning of the play, is said to be this terrific sword fighter, and that he seems and unseems his opponent. And the author makes big dramatic use of the term seems and unseems. In fact, throughout the play, a lot of the seamster imagery is given to Macbeth. And immediately after that description, a character says, "Noble Macbeth, well does he deserve his name." Well, scholar studying Hebrew knows that Macbeth means seamster in Hebrew. So the pun is unavoidable and completely straightforward. And the whole literature is just fraught with that kind of stuff. Things that are just obvious, but weren't understood or recognized because scholars look at it through the wrong interpretive framework. And so they don't make any sense of the plays, all of the cannibalism in the plays. I mean, Hamlet, the name means maker of ham. The character that he kills is named Polonius, which means sausage. In Romeo and Juliet, the capelet means, fish. It's a kind of fish that you eat. And then, of course, the empty tomb scene, or the scene at the end of Romeo and Juliet is all about cannibalism. The cannibal jokes are just throughout the Shakespearean literature, and so it's an ugly thing. The Shakespearean literature, which supposedly is this civilizing and uplifting creation of humanity, is in fact a a really dark black humor response to a dark and black humored Roman false flag literature. You know, earlier I'd mentioned Psalm 137, which has the description of the daughters of Babylon who take the Gentile infants and dash them against the rocks. Well, Shakespeare quotes the Psalms in his literature 137 times.
You're kidding.
So you can see that, and of course, the Psalm that she most quotes is Psalm 137. So anyway, so again, it's not, you know, this stuff isn't too hard to see if you have the right interpretive framework. And that's one of the reasons why, even though it's, you know, maybe not the best page turner in the world, but I really recommend people read and study Caesar's Messiah, because you get the basis from which you can see the humor that the individuals who rule have among themselves.
Well, this is what's really hard to see. We think of the Bible as very solemn, and it's not full of jokes, and so this is something that's, when people first hear this, they said, "Well, this, you're saying it's just a joke? I mean, that's absurd. This is the foundation of our culture, of our spirituality." And but the thing is that you know, the ruling class at the time, they had one level for the masses and something else for the classes. They had you know, they wanted it to be sounding spiritual on the surface, but underneath, you know, they were laughing at everyone else. They had in jokes. They use puns. They use this is something that Joe's work has revealed, that so many scholars have said, "Oh, that's an odd name. That's an odd name in this character." But when Joe argues that, well, this is satire, that then it finally clears up the mystery. Why, Joe? What's the
like Joseph of Arimathea?
Joseph of Arimathea.
You know, they no one has ever found the city. They're all looking for Arimathea. Well, if you look in Josephus, you have the exact same story with three being crucified, one being taken down and surviving, and the Roman commander gets begged by Joseph, you know, take him down. Well, that's Joseph Bar Matthias, right?
Yeah,
that's his name. And the character in the Gospels, Joseph Arimathea, they've just dropped the B, but in typology, it's never verbatim. You always just leave enough of a pattern. And when the entire story is laid out, it's just perfectly obvious where the character Joseph Arimathea comes from. He's just a typologic character that's created so that there is this divine, quote, connection to the Flavian military campaign.
What about Jesus Barabbas?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, it just goes on forever. I mean, Barabbas means son of the father, and there is just an endless stream of punning within both the Gospels and the Shakespearean literature that the oligarchs enjoy and the cognoscenti enjoy, but that the everyday citizen doesn't get to see. We're just expected to bear the heel of the boot of history as these individuals set up their power structures. That's what we get. They laugh and we get destroyed. So it's time that we understand their humor and perhaps stop being the butt of the joke.
Is this why Shakespeare's work have been so propped up, and basically this is why it recurs everywhere? I mean, this is basically, like, you know, the
of course. I mean, in all honesty, the stories are completely ludicrous. There's just a very powerful organization that loves this material and promotes it constantly because it's funny to them. They know perfectly well that what the meanings of the plays are. Just as an example, when Israel was established, the first thing they did was put on a play, Hamlet. and David Ben-Gurion, I believe, who became the prime minister, actually played Hamlet.
Oh, really?
You're kidding.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And so in the play, I mean, here's something that you just wonder, where is scholarship? You know, they just can't see anything. I mean, in Hamlet, they have this mysterious thing where Hamlet goes to Claudius, you know, he's got some conflict going with this guy who supposedly killed his father, and he says wormwood. He just uses the word wormwood. And he repeats it over again. You see in the Gospels, whenever the authors want to underline the importance of a concept, they'll simply write it more than once. Well, here Shakespeare uses this concept wormwood over again, and people, there's just all sorts of bizarre explanations. Well, where it comes from is in the book of Revelation that you have these five angels that are described, and one has a big battle on the land, one has a big battle on the sea, one is poisoned with wormwood, one has a eclipse of the sun and the moon, and the other leads the grasshoppers in a 5-month siege. Well, in fact, these are the Caesars that were made divine by the Roman imperial cult. Before Domitian, there were only 5 Caesars that had been deified, and they were Julius Caesar, who had the big battle on the land fighting, Augustus, who was most famous for his sea battle, Claudius, who was poisoned, wormwood, and then Vespasian, who, when he became consul, he was famous for having an eclipse of the sun and the moon, and then Titus, who led the 5-month siege against Jerusalem. Well, if you know who the divine Caesars are, you look at that and you go, well, it's obvious who wormwood's got to be. It's Claudius. So now when you go to the Shakespearean literature,
King Claudius,
the joke is not exactly hard to see. You know, I mean, Hamlet is just making a little mocking comment on the fact that the Claudius, who is a type of the of the Roman Caesar, who is being typed in Revelation, now Shakespeare is just doing it over again. And so you can see how there is this unified stream of comedy that runs through the literature. And I mean, it just runs through all the literature. I could give examples of just all sorts of it. In fact, just for anyone who really wants to do research, simply Google the Kipling's poem, The Burden of Jerusalem, and I think you'll find a very interesting area of research, particularly the letters that Roosevelt and Churchill exchanged concerning it. But, you know, not to digress going forward, back to Claudius. So this is, you know, just how they laugh at us. It's and once the literature is in existence, then they can simply promote it. So it fills up our minds, right? You have these Shakespearean plays.
Yeah.
I mean, just think of some poor college student who is forced to read the New Testament and then the Shakespearean literature.
Ugh.
In neither case does the individual have any understanding of the actual basis of the literature. You see, and this stuff fills up your head, then how can you think clearly?
Amazing. That explains probably also my kind of intuitive just resistance to some of the work.
you're simply too, your mind is too alive and intelligent to stoop to this absurd bloodbath that the Shakespearean literature, you know, is represents. And always we're told that this is just some kind of important part of our culture that we just have to absorb.
Exactly. Well, this is the foundations almost of European culture,
exactly.
You know? Yeah. Wow.
And it is the foundations. Wow. It's the foundation of the playpen. You see?
Yeah.
It's the foundation of what it keeps us from being able to see the oligarchs, be able to see who is controlling us.
It's an insult. It's a slap in the face and people don't understand and know about it, you know, and then.
Of course. I mean, think of how a Jewish person who knows the Gospels thinks about a crucifix.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, they understand it's just a mocking insult against their people's catastrophe. Well, the Shakespearean literature is just another example of the kind of bitterness and hatred that has not been exposed and therefore continues to fester and to animate behavior. And that's why, again, just bringing the origins of the Christian religion to light is very useful. It seems like it's just some little arcane, you know, kind of history. Well, who cares? The fact is that these forces are still in play because they haven't been exposed to sunlight. They haven't been really ever released. The real hatreds that were put into place in the first century are still with us, and the literature is still influencing everyone in a negative way.
That is fascinating. Amelia Bassano. Gotta Google
Amelia
that.
Bassano.
Yeah, and check that out.
She wrote it.
Wow.
She wrote all the plays, yeah.
Have you gone through all of Shakespeare's work at this stage?
You know, it's funny. I mean, my career as a Shakespearean scholar didn't last a long time. I have a lot of other stuff I'm working on, but I read Titus Andronicus. I was like on a Wednesday. I kind of got it. So then I got the complete works of Shakespeare, and I spent the weekend reading it, and I essentially decoded the plays. I could see what how the symbolic framework was. And so I called a friend of mine named John Hudson, who's actually a Shakespearean scholar, and I explained it to him. And so I said, look, let's, you know, write books about this. And we wrote two books. One explains the plays, and the other is an intellectual biography of Amelia Bassano. John did more of the work on the biography, and I did more of the work on the plays. But, you know, I did that some time ago. The moment to release the books hasn't really come about because, frankly, Caesar's Messiah hasn't penetrated deeply enough into culture. And that since this is, again, it's sort of like the single strand, it's a subset. You have to, what has happened is you have a building block of literary structure, and you have to have the foundation before you can take the next step. And someone who hasn't read Caesar's Messiah would never really understand Revelation. And someone who doesn't have that understanding, in no way would they understand Shakespeare. So one of the things we're going to try to do at in the October venue is to bring more of this information out in a general form to try to get some interest in it, so that we'd like to bring more scholars in, more critics, to help expose all of this. It's really critical that this literature, the real reality of it, is given to the citizens at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And it's right there in front of our eyes. It's, you know, that's part of the way they've done it in other settings, just as you described before, with some of the symbolism and everything else. It's kind of, it has that same you know, feel to it, but in this case it's a longer running you know, joke, if you will, or insult.
It's a 2,000 year old vicious black humor that these two groups shared among themselves, and it is still with us. It's still understood by the oligarchs. And these are the foundations of the playpen. I mean, these are part of what makes our minds not able to see history clearly and recognize that, in fact, what we think of a democracy is a playpen of control and enslavement.
What happens if we don't watch out, Joe? If we don't get smart to some of this stuff, what's going on right now, and how, you know, again, the fighting of many of these groups are, you know, incessant in the way that they, you know, people are squeezed in between in this fight, and that they're using everything they can at their disposal to get their, you know, agenda through, and their revenge, if you will, as well.
We'll be exterminated.
That is no good.
So we definitely have to get smarter, and the oligarchs, they're ahead of us, and so we do have
ahead of the curve and ahead of, yep, of the control of technology. They're few in number but mighty in weaponry, and unfortunately they're awfully good at listening at this point, it seems like, now that they have all the devices planted so they can just follow everyone. They can with computers analyze all of the you know, conversations, and thereby know who is essentially trying to preserve themselves. You see, whenever citizens now try to communicate a displeasure, you know, about the government, about the oligarchs, this will be known. So it's going to be very hard, very tricky to try to organize. But, you know, again, we're not helpless. We simply need to have the facts of our circumstances understood by a lot of people. And I honestly believe that if 5 or 6 million people understood with real clarity what our situation is, that would be enough to tip the whole system over. Because I don't think that with that number, you could really maintain the playpen any longer. I think that the whole ability to control the minds of the populations would disappear. People like Bill O'Reilly and, the different individuals that are given to us as sources of news, no one would believe these individuals. Here's just one little bright note. A friend of mine was in Hungary as a young woman and went through the entire system under the Soviet Union. And then one morning when she was about 17, the political officer didn't come to class because the Soviet Union had fallen. And the class immediately began to mimic, mock, and laugh about the political officer. So that even though that they'd had 17 years of indoctrination, the moment that they had the capacity to be human, it immediately returned. I think that the mind control that the population of oligarchs use is really very, very weak and can easily be cracked if enough people are aware of it. It's really kind of the Wizard of Oz, you know, the man behind the screen. Well, Frank Baum, who wrote that charming story, was a member of a group called the Uplifters of Satan.
Nice.
Which, with
I think it was Uplifters of Lucifer.
Uplifters of Lucifer with people like Walt Disney. And H.R. Haldeman's father, I believe, was in the group. So this was the Wizard of Oz is just another example of the comedy of the oligarchs. And the character of the Wizard of Oz is really a representation of their control of the media, that it's just completely ridiculous, that it's just a man behind the screen talking nonsense. And all that we have to do is just get people to recognize it. Their influence will disappear. Just as an example, I mean, how many people would it have taken in World War I on both sides of the trenches to know that, in fact, the oligarchs were using the war as an extermination device? I think if a couple million soldiers were aware of that, I think you would have seen the war come to a completely different conclusion.
Yeah. Well, the remake of that, just to be briefer, of course, the Oz or Oz the Great and Powerful also was a complete whitewash, by the way, in terms of how they were trying to basically portray that the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain was basically a good guy and that he did what he did because he had to do it to save everyone in the city. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, he was a good guy if you were an oligarch.
Yeah, well, exactly.
It's great, you know,
produced by Joe Ruth.
He represents that, you know, they have this amazing ability just to make people believe that they are powerful and they can uplift Lucifer whenever they want. So, look, you know, these are really serious times. No goofing around here. I'm dead serious. Citizens just have to start getting more alert, more organized, and they have to recognize that the government itself has been influenced and is influenced by a group that wants to destroy them. So you have to develop other methods of health, other methods of security, other methods of political activity. And you have to start today.
Yeah, I agree. This is about predictability as well. I think to create a human that is so basic in their thought process and behavioral patterns that they can effectively, you know, analyze the massive amounts of data that they have been collecting through, you know, the NSA and everything else. And I mean, DARPA is working hand in glove with the NSA right now to basically replicate the neural network of the human brain to develop an artificial intelligence to actually achieve this goal of analyzing everything, you know? Unbelievable.
Well, once they're, you can see where the technology goes. I mean, it's going to go to the point where the device in front of you is completely controlled by Oz. And Oz has your neural patterns totally understood. And the power that the wizard has at this point is not fictitious and smoke and mirrors, but rather mechanical and direct.
Yeah.
Again, it's looking at Gregory Bateson and MK Ultra and the counterculture. Once you start to see these things as experiments that the oligarchs are performing to try to see how the mind can be controlled and what they can do to reduce the population's ability to rebel, you know, that was 50 years ago. I mean, what kind of drugs do they have today? What kind of techniques have they been able to develop? This whole business of top secret is something that citizens need to pry open. I mean, just what in the hell is going on? There's so many top secret companies in the United States that they're literally an industry unto themselves. The number's staggering, like 60,000 or something, you know. So we're not in a democracy if we don't know what is going on inside those top secret events. And top secret just has to give way to rights of the citizen, congressional, constitutional rights of you know, of self-defense and the rights to privacy and things like that. So we just, you know, violence won't work, I don't believe. I think, you know, it's always an option if you have no choice but to defend yourself. But
yeah.
What is needed is public disclosure and a political organization to essentially take control of the system by the citizens and restore the Constitution.
And we have to have the clear reasoning skills to, if we do start, you know, build up our own institutions, that it doesn't get taken over and infiltrated, which is a huge challenge. But we can't defend ourselves in that situation if we don't get back clear reasoning skills. And that, yeah, again, that big challenge.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's one thing. We should not sit and curse the oligarchs. You know, say we were able to determine them precisely with DNA testing, and it is a family. Say it's related somehow to some, you know, ancient group that somehow has come through time and wants to reap vengeance against a particular group. Say it is that case. Well, you know something? Shouldn't surprise anyone. We're in a food chain. You know, power is always going to be at issue. And citizens just have to automatically and always suspect that tyranny is around the corner. We need to put in place systems that will always operate, like Ryan was mentioning earlier, that you don't hold reason like a jewel and you don't hold freedom like a jewel. They're processes. They're not static events. We have just fallen asleep. We've been given this fake reality, the playpen with the welfare state and government food stamps and things like this.
Yeah.
The citizen just needs to take back their responsibility and their power. And so, no one should feel any rancor. They should just at the same time not be compromised in any way. Just go forward in the spirit of self-defense and try to restructure our political system so the citizens have a real impact in it.
Yeah, it's intraspecies kleptoparatism, as Richard Grove and others have highlighted, and the, the secrets and the clues, you know, are not going to fall into people's lap either. This is about personal responsibility and to be that person who are aware of the choices that you make, how it affects, you know, yourself and other people around you, and just kind of in that supply chain, just do the best you can to avoid, you know, promoting and helping along the agenda of these people we've been talking about.
Right. But there's no excuses. Look, everyone knows someone. Try to convince them of the accuracy of your fear and the importance of it. The importance of vetting media information independently. The suspicion that the oligarchs control both sides of the political dialectic. I mean, that's just an obvious point of reasoning that all citizens should begin with.
Yeah.
So things like that you can unify around and you can grow politically from are to be developed without any haste or with any excuse. And then once your group is large enough, unify with another group. You see, there are already so many groups and campuses, humanitarian groups. There's so much concern over the environment, over militarism, over the oligarchic, increase in the wealth of the world. All of these groups that have these concerns can be quickly unified into a political structure. We don't need to be that big. We only need to be large enough to have an impact within the presidential races and within the congressional races inside the United States. Once we are 5%, they wouldn't ever be able to stop us or to keep this kind of information from getting to the citizenry. And then, as I said, I believe, you have 5 million people who know the truth. You'll have 200 million people who are thinking about the truth within a matter of days. So
yeah,
this is very doable, and we just have to go through the work to get it done.
Well, exactly. Really good point. This has been fascinating, gentlemen. It always is fascinating on this topic as well. Some sober thoughts, and of course, some extraordinary clues and revelations about some of the most popular literature in the world, and of course, the larger picture that is tied in. This is just a fascinating subject, and of course, we could go on here for hours, literally, because there's much more to tie into this. But we will wrap up things here for this time, gentlemen. And I hope that you have a great time again at the event here coming up in October the 19th, to be precise. Why don't we just shift over to you again, Ryan, and you can give us the details and the website and everything else for people.
For details, go to covertmessiah.com. Again, it's on the 19th of October. Buy tickets on the website.
Very good. And Joseph, give us your website and some of your titles as well.
Yeah,
and your
go upcoming. To caesarsmessiah.com. The book is available. The DVD is available.
Very good. Great stuff. Thank you so much, guys. Really appreciate this. It's been another good one. And I hope we can have you both back at some point and do it again. So good luck at the event, first of all.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, friends and members, for joining us today. We certainly could tie in an endless amount of history into this discussion, and I think there will be further opportunities to do so later, and I bet more revelations to Joseph's work will fall into place as he proceeds his thesis as well. I hope you found it stimulating and challenging and have some things to look into. And of course, also check the link on the program page to Kipling's The Burden of Jerusalem, this poem, and see what you think of that. We'll be back with more in just a few days. Enjoy yourself, keep searching, and we will talk soon. Take care.